Welcome, both listeners, to another episode of Making It in Movie Making. Today, I am talking to Victoria Hutton, who is a filmmaker that I came to know when we were both involved in the Buffalo Dreams Film Festival last year. And so now the plan is to catch up.
We won the same award.
We won the same award. We did, yeah. Filmmaker to watch. So you got to watch us both. And not only do you have to watch us both, you have to listen to us both. Okay. This is Victoria Hutton. So I'm just gonna let you ramble for a bit. Tell me about your kind of filmmaking hopes, desires, aspirations, and experiences. No pressure.
Yeah, I have to talk about myself. So I got into filmmaking. Well, I got into like film watching when I was 19, and well, actually 17 probably, when I first like. So I'm trying to figure out how to start the story. So I was starting in opera singing when I was 16. And then through opera singing, I started to see certain like opera movies. And the first one I saw was Bergman's Magic Flute. And then that opened up the world of the Criterion Collection and all of, like these like archival, like important films that like I guess have artistic value. And then so I started watching more and more of those. And I saw all sorts of very interesting films from like all over the world, things that you would never really see in any theater, especially where I'm from in Buffalo, but even in New York, sort of rare to see films from, you know, like Czech Republic or Japan, and India, places like very far away that normally like you would never know about these films. But I got exposure to all those things like through that archive, and that then I started to think that I wanted to make films. And I first started with acting. I was trying to do make it as an actor starting at the age of 17, and I met this one guy in New York City that was a student filmmaker, and I tried out for his film, and I didn't make it because he said that my performance lacked appropriate nuance, but I was 17, so that makes a lot of sense. And but we maintained a friendship, and then my plan was to start making movies with him, but then, you know, he's a professional, so life gets in the way. And then eventually, after a lot of trying different things in life, I finally felt like I was ready to start making like my own movie 2 years ago, so in 2021. And that was my first attempt to make a movie. And
I got a few things I want to bounce off of. So I guess firstly, like, do you intentionally gravitate towards foreign cinema? Like, because you mentioned that you watch a lot of those films, like, is that kind of your niche, like where you want to go, or are you open to like mainstream, like Cocaine Bear and the like?
Does it have to be Cocaine Bear?
It doesn't have to be Cocaine Bear. It's just the most ridiculous thing that came into my head.
Yeah, I mean, I like some mainstream movies, but the thing is, like, in the world cinema, they do things like in every culture, there's certain cultural norms, but sometimes those norms can be like, I guess, restrictive. So I found that in a lot of world cinema, it's gone beyond like what we might imagine. I mean, like certain Japanese, like I remember there's this one ghost film that I watched called, I think, Black Cat, and it was made in the 70s, maybe 60s, and they did a lot with like aero people like kind of flying in the air with like and like the clothes like flying up with them and stuff, and it looked amazing. And it's like, I guess, like visual innovations that each like country would do that, you know, could be an inspiration. And I noticed that a lot of those American filmmakers, like if you ask them what their influences are, they usually say something very similar, that they're not necessarily influenced by mainstream like Hollywood, but they're more so, even Quentin Tarantino, I think, was influenced by Lady Snowblood when he made Kill Bill. So it's like, I think that like in a way that is the, it should be the basis that all filmmakers go towards, because there's just so much creativity and richness in those early films. And not only that, but it's the origins of where we're at now, because the fact is, like, jump cuts, I'm pretty sure it was Godard that started using jump cuts, And I don't know of anyone that was using it before him. It's like those are the sort of people that innovated. And so it's always best to go to the originals when you're attempting to make something, I think. And then I have a whole like affinity for Bresson. That is a whole other topic. But I mean Robert Bresson, the French filmmaker. But I hope that answered it though.
Yeah, so do you think yourself as a filmmaker now that you'd be influenced by other filmmakers' styles, or do you have your own little, weird quirks against the norm that you like want to try out?
I think that, I mean, I hope that what I make is more reflective of my own mentality. I do believe it is because my film, The Last Option, which was my first try in filmmaking, it has like kind of a darkness to it, but then there's also hope. And that's how I kind of view the world. I'm very affected by how dark things can be and how I guess people have a hard time like seeing each other or being compassionate towards one another, but I do see hope at the end that they can get over it somehow. And I think that like the same like that dichotomy of darkness and like a like being in a thriller and also like hopefulness and light is what how I see the world. But my favorite filmmakers, it's like I think it's kind of I don't think that like my favorite ever is Robert Bresson, but I don't think that my films are anywhere near like near his. I wouldn't say that they're similar at all, actually. I would like seeing those two, it's like those are definitely two different people, but there's I guess like a similar values, if that
This,
makes.
yeah, I mean, there's a couple of things in your film, The Last Option, that stood out to me, and I was like, because when I watch films now, I'm like, what can I steal? And like the
I
one,
want to know more about that, actually.
sorry, you do that too.
I don't know. I actually I'm just curious what you mean by that.
So you do this really interesting thing with sound. So like after the first guy, the like creepy dude, is like making his moves or whatever, you have this moment where you get all these kind of like your thoughts like flooding into the soundtrack, and like this weird echo. I was like, oh, that sounds really cool. And there's me like trying to get rid of like the hum in the background, and she's doing this like multi-layer thing that I love.
Yeah.
So like, did that come from somewhere, or was that just like an instinct?
I was influenced like so the you do you know that notice how like there's like violins also playing in the background. Like I was really influenced by The Shining. And so I was like that was one of them, but yeah, how did that come about? That was how I imagined that scene. Yeah, it was like 'cause I don't know where I've seen that before. I mean, it's probably been done before. I can't remember any specific thing, but no, that was always a part of it because the idea was that she was talking endlessly about something that really is like it's also specialized knowledge, and she doesn't even realize that no one would even know it. So she's just talking. It's like that was, I guess, what I interpreted the guy to be taking it, like how he would receive it, because it's just all of it just sounds like garbled anyway. But and technically speaking, I did not like edit that technically. I told the editor to do that. So, I mean, like I think that you also edit your own movies. So,
I
I mean,
mean,
that's.
I don't like to ask people, but I did notice that in your credits, and I'm like, oh, and there's like a company there. Like, is the company like your company name, or like, because for me, it's like a film by Richard Fish, catering by Richard Fish, like set
Well,
dressing.
that guy I hired out, like he was like a friend of a friend. I didn't really know too much about him. He said that he would be willing to do it for not like very much, so like I just went with him. But like I'm like looking to do more by myself now, just because I know more about editing. But like so you as an editor, like you yeah, I don't know where I was going with that. I'm sorry.
I mean, me, I just keep bashing things until they work. I don't know. Like, it's not, sometimes it's planned out, but a lot of time it's, why doesn't this work? And I don't know. Like, it's planned, but like, I think it's weird because your film looks, at first, it kind of gets more and more visually interesting as it goes on. Because when it first, it opens really well, and then it cuts to you, like you, and it's like, oh, this is just like a normal, commonplace thing. Could be filmed like anywhere. And then there's little things going on with the mise en scène, like your folder, or like when you get into the second guy's who just comes across as really creepy to me. But like when you go into like his room and like looking at the books in the background or like the things on the shelf, like everything's like, oh yeah, this looks like this is where this person exists. And I liked that because a lot of times I think with these low budget things, people don't think about that enough. And like whereas yours, it kind of like everything looks like it was designed in a good way, you
Yeah,
know?
I wanted to do even more with the design, honestly. I felt like it was really good, and I had help with my team to make it like look like that. A lot of help from the cinematographer. But yeah, it was done in only 3 days, the whole thing. So there wasn't a whole lot of time, and on top of it, yeah, just not a lot of time to do a lot of things. So
So when did you actually film that? For the shoot?
it was filmed in November. I believe it was like the week before Thanksgiving, like exactly the weekend before. And one of my actors came in from New York City, so he had like almost no time to act. He was just there for the weekend, and then he went back to New York City.
Oh, you did that here in
Yeah,
Buffalo.
I did
Okay.
it here. Well, yeah. So I believe it was the 17th, the 19th, and the 20th
Was
were
this
the dates.
2021?
2021, yeah. I believe that those were the dates.
That's so weird because that's the exact time that my film was showing at the screening room, like having the premiere.
Oh, yeah?
So, yeah, so there's a lot of strange crossover with this the shared award, the double award or whatever it is. So you going to New York, was that a I'm gonna go to New York and make it as an actor? Like what? When did you do that?
Yeah, initially I loved acting, 'cause I always had a lot of emotions, and I felt like acting was a sort of healthy way to express those emotions, and also to be a part of like story making, storytelling, which I've always loved. And I went to an acting class in New York City for a while, and it went really well. I met really amazing people there. I was actually surprised at how many of the actors that I met were not at all self-centered, but were actually very compassionate people that just really wanted to explore the psychology of others through their acting. So I met really great people when I was there. And I think I was kind of too young when I first started my acting career, because I just wasn't like I looked. I had like a very like ch chubby face, and like I had a lot of baby fat, and I just looked like my acting was like good. I mean, my acting teacher didn't complain, and she had in mind like certain agents and everything, but like I could see that when like I went for these auditions, that I think that I was not like I just didn't look mature enough to really be considered for like any leading role. Probably now it would be different, but at the time I just wasn't. That wasn't what was happening. And also I was kind of disappointed with the scripts that I was getting, because they just seemed very like excessively violent, excessively sexual. And like even one of them that I auditioned for was like about a 13-year-old that had a relationship with either, I think, like a guy in his mid-30s or early 40s, something like that. So I wasn't happy with the stories or like the parts that I was reading for, and I felt that I wanted to like do more good in the world. So I put acting on hold, and then I thought about what I wanted to do. And for a while I tried medicine, and I tried like learning Eastern medicine, and then that was really complicated by COVID. So then after I quit that school, like I thought about what, and then now I just went back to acting. I mean, not acting, but just filmmaking. But I would rather make my own stories like as a writer and a director, rather than as an actor, because I just prefer my own stories, like I for the most time. I mean, I enjoy seeing movies, you know. It's not as if there's no movies that I enjoy, but it's just I think that a lot of actors, not only myself, but a lot of them struggle with finding really good roles, or roles that they feel that they can connect with, if that makes sense.
And then when they find those roles, there's competition for them, so not everybody gets to do them.
Oh, true. Yeah, true. And I think it's, you know, auditions are hard too, because you really don't see like everything about that person. You've only got a couple minutes with them, and like a really good director, maybe they could see through it, but like a lot of times the directors aren't even casting and at that time, or like depending on where you are in the audition process. So I think that and that's why for my movies too, I've tried to get to know my actors before I start filming. Like I've tried to talk with them a lot and see where they are, not because I want to pigeonhole them into a certain character, but I think that I think I do have the ability to see past what someone presents and to sort of see their potential rather than what's just in front of me.
That's an interesting point. I think so. As an actor, you know, if you're sending a self-tape or if you're going for an audition or something, even choosing how you're going to present that part in such a small way is difficult. You know, like you'll get sides for self-tape. I don't know if you had the same thing, and you're kind of like, okay, I could do it this way or I could do it this way. Whereas, like you're saying, if you kind of build some sort of connection with the actor, that sort of thing can kind of come out, and there can be kind of negotiation on both sides as to like really what the part is.
Yeah, I mean, and there's precedent for doing it that way as well, because a really good filmmaker from China, Wong Kar-wai, I hope I'm saying his name right. He did it that way as well, where he would have his actors or the people, and then he would make a script around the people that he's got at his disposal. Or if he had a script, like then he would kind of know like who could play what. But like he did it like the opposite way, and I do think it's sort of strange how it's normally done that you would write a character and then you'd have to find a person to fit the character. I just think it's not my preferred way of doing it, but that is the standard with for Hollywood and with casting in general.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess at the kind of top end, a lot of it is just business. Like, who's popular right now? Let's stick them in there because people got to watch that person.
That's very true. Yeah, it's probably like politics and nowadays too, probably whether you're an influencer would have some pull. Like if you've got a following and it's very commercial, very money centered. So
So, what age were you when you moved out to New York, and how long did you stay there?
I was so so I stayed well my, I have family in New York City, so I've always kind of been back and forth, but I stayed there briefly for a summer when I was 19, and then I moved there for 4 years between the years of 2013 to, I think, no, it was, yeah, 17. So 13 to 17, but it's actually 18, but so like maybe 4.5 years then.
So the whole time you were pushing yourself as an actor, you were straight to New York. You didn't do any of that in Buffalo.
Yeah, I didn't do any of it in Buffalo. I mean, very little. Like I did some acting training in Buffalo with the guy here, Frank Rossi, and yeah, and then I pursued acting training in New York City for a while, for like probably like most of the time that I was there.
But you say now your focus is mostly making your own stuff. Is that because you see yourself more as a writer director, or you just don't see the parts you want to do, or like the opportunities to get those parts?
I think that I see myself more as like a storyteller. So and I really love being a director and directing actors. Like I really do like that, and I don't really always want to be an actor because I think that I want to have control more of how the story gets told. I want to be more of the leader and figure out how things get done. And I think I'm more comfortable in the director role than I am in the actor role. So even my plans for like future movies is like I don't really see myself even acting in them. I'd rather not if I can avoid it. Sometimes I do just because it's more, as you were saying earlier, it's like it's difficult at our level to work with actors and like because like these are like free, like no one's getting paid by this, you know, it's just everyone's just kind of volunteering their time. Like maybe some of them are getting reels from it, you know, but it's like hard to offer your actors what they really deserve because of the level that we're at. So I do feel bad sometimes, and sometimes I will like substitute myself if I have to, but I'd really rather work with actors though. And there's some really good ones in Buffalo.
So, were you intending to be in The Last Option, or did that just kind of happen?
It just happened because I knew I could reliably be there. I just didn't want to, because it was my first film, and actually Actually, so the backstory of that too is like I wasn't gonna do it at all. Like my friend in New York City, I was asking him to do it with me because I really didn't want to do it alone. And then the whole COVID thing happened, and then it just got really hard, like logistically, to get him here. And it so he was supposed to direct, and so he wanted to direct me as an actor, but I trusted him because I've known him for like since I was 17. And at the time I think I was 27, so like I've known him for a decade. And so I wanted to work with him. I wanted him to direct me. I trusted him to do it. And then it wasn't possible, so then I just, retained it. I was just gonna keep myself as the character because I couldn't
So
get someone.
was he not involved at all in the end?
In the end, no, yeah, because
Mm.
he had his own responsibilities in New York City, and it just it was like sort of like more casual at first, and then I started getting people that like were actually quite good here in Buffalo to sign up for it, so it became bigger than what it was originally supposed to be, I think.
I mean, yeah, looking at the like, it seems like a small film, but when you look at the credits, there's a lot of people involved, and I was like, oh, this is quite a big thing. I also noticed you credit yourself second, even though you're clearly the main character. I don't.
Oh, I think I did an order of appearance.
Oh, okay,
Yeah.
that makes sense.
Because I appear second.
I didn't even think about that. So let's I don't know, maybe I can edit this soon enough to you so you can use it as a promotional piece. Why don't you tell me about.
Like to say something about like the other people I had in the film though
Oh,
too.
please.
So I got like my friend Satoshi Sugiyama from Japan. I met him in New York City. He's a good friend of mine. He's now based in Japan, living there as a jazz musician. And I told him about my film, and then I remember I needed music, and then I asked him if he would like to compose, and he was very enthusiastic about it. He immediately composed like the most amazing music. I mean, it's like because he's, I mean, obviously he's a professional, and but I think that his music actually sort of like elevated it as well, and gave it a higher production value because of that.
The whole thing is very polished, and people like me, I'm like, yeah, that's not fun. I'm just getting jealous. But no, it's really good. So I'm interested in, because I haven't seen the music video that you have coming up at this festival now. So what can you tell both of my listeners about that? So see if they can, because you're showing both your films at the festival, right?
Yeah, they accepted both. So, yeah, so I've always wanted to, my first films that I ever watched were opera pieces that were made into film. That was how I got into filmmaking in the first place. And it's a very, there's not a whole lot of movies that are made in that sort of genre. There's a very famous example called Tales of Hoffman by was made by Paul Pressburger. That was in Technicolor, and a lot of people cite that as being a very like visually striking film. But there's not a whole lot of movies made in that genre. But I'm an opera singer, so I love opera a lot. And there's a lot of like really beautiful poetry and visuals that the lyrics convey that is no one would really know about unless they read it or unless they took the time to like research it and stuff. So one of my projects that I've been developing is making more opera music videos that will visually render the poetry and the language of the poetry.
So is this you singing in these videos?
Yes, in this one, I just made one so far. I plan to make more.
So let's talk about that then. So how, I mean, it doesn't seem to me like a commonplace thing to, you're just living your life as a kid and you're like, you know what, I'm gonna be an opera singer. Like, how does that happen?
Yeah, well, that happened. I first started singing when I was 12, and my mom like sensed my passion for singing, so she helped me with that, and she brought me to auditions at Eastman, and then I got in. And at first, they had me singing like Broadway repertoire, and then I came across opera when I was there, and I was just amazed. Like I was in tears because I couldn't believe how like such a beautiful art form existed, and I just never knew anything about it. And I think that I was already around like 15 or 16 when I finally had seen it. So it even took a while when I was at Eastman to even come across it. It's just very hard to get to sometimes. And so and then I saw my first opera at 16, and then I knew that like I definitely wanted to learn this art form and learn how to sing it because it just seems so deep, and it seemed like all of these emotions were being expressed through this music, and it seemed much more so than even Broadway in a sense, because Broadway, there's emotions in it, but the music is, it just kind of accompanies the emotions rather than in opera. It was the the emotion was the music. It wasn't as if you're acting it. There was no need for acting. It was just being played out, and I loved it, and I wanted to know more about it. So I found a woman in New York City, and then she showed me another teacher in Rochester, and then I started learning opera singing. I'm sorry, what was the original question? I
I don't
get
know,
this.
but keep talking. I was talking about how did you originally get into opera, but you're covering that. But by all means, continue. It's fascinating.
Okay, good. Yeah, and then I started learning opera singing, and it's taken me a while because I started when I was 16 or 17, and then I did it for 2 years at Eastman, and then I took a break from it because I was doing other things. And it's a hard thing to learn because you need to learn how to balance your voice, and it's the way that you have to learn it will sound paradoxical to anyone who hasn't experienced it. And it took me a very long time to get the right coordination. Maybe, and I think other people, it's different for them. I think other people got it very fast, but for me, it took me longer, I think, to learn how to coordinate. So I'm at the point now where I can coordinate my voice pretty well, but I don't know.
So
I
what try to explain, like, what does that mean to someone like me who knows nothing about opera?
think that the term, there's a lot of terms in opera to try to convey what exactly is happening. It's like you have to sort of open your voice and relax, but at the same time keep it engaged and tense. And that's it just tends to be like some people relax too much and other people tense too much. And it's a very long process of trying to figure out how to keep both going at the same time. And that's, I think that's the tricky part. It was for me. And I think it, for most people it is.
Do you think, I mean, what's the reason that operas tend to be in foreign languages, in Italian and German? Like, is there something about those languages that lend themselves to singing that way, or?
Yeah, it's covered a lot of times in my training that especially Italian, because it tends to be vowel centered, that it's easier to sing, and because you have less vowels obstructing. I mean, even in Italian you could have some issues, but like so certain vowels, especially when you get to the upper part of the register, like if you try to sing them too, like if you try to enunciate it or have your diction too perfect, you can kind of garble the sound of the note, and it will be not become as pure. It'll become like it'll sound too off. So as an opera singer, you always have to like modify vowels to sound like yeah, pleasant with the music, because firstly you're an instrumentalist as a sing like as a singer, like your voice is your instrument. So that's the first consideration. So I do you're absolutely right that it's to sing in Italian, and then also German and French are all languages that I think are useful to sing in. English maybe is a bit more difficult. They say that the Slavic languages also have some difficulties. Yeah. Have you heard that from somewhere? Because it seems like you already knew about it.
No, I just, from my very limited awareness of opera, like, it's just something that I've observed in the world, and I wondered if maybe there was a reason for it. Like, why don't they do them in English? Is it just for some sort of like mystique, you know?
Yeah, like even Mozart's operas, I'm not sure if you're aware of it, but of course Mozart was Austrian, and half of his operas, even more than half maybe, are all in Italian, even though he was a German speaker. And the reason for that was because Italian was seen as the language that produced like it was e easiest for singers to sing in, so that it was most beautiful sound. That was the idea back then, and still is true.
I do like Italian. I don't know, fairly basic Italian myself, but I can get by if I have to. Not to sing it though. Don't know if I'd ever dare try that. So then from there, you discovered films using opera, and then you did a deep dive on cinema of the world, and now you know everything there is to know about film. When's the feature?
What's that?
When's the feature film? What's ne what's when's that gonna happen? Or are you gonna work on these opera videos for a while? Like what are you kind of where are you at?
Yeah, I'm trying to get a lot of videos made. I do want to make a feature. I have my cast in mind already, and I've been trying to narrow down the story. I don't know if you ever have this, but I have like I love making stories so much that sometimes I can make so many at once. And then because I made so many at once, they all sort of have an equal value because they were made so easily and so quickly. And I think it's a bit difficult sometimes to judge which one's worth actually producing and making. Do you know what I mean?
I think a related thing that I have is when I'm in the middle of working on something, I get an idea for something else, or I start working on something else. I'm making notes for the thing, but then I have to keep reminding myself, finish the thing I'm doing first, or I'll have, dozens of part-baked ideas. And I'd rather, like, it makes more sense to me. Okay, well, I'll just finish one thing and then go back and look and see what's next.
I know how that feels. Yeah.
But certain things stick with you. There's like ideas that float around in my head, and then when I start writing, I just kind of spew onto paper and see what comes together. Because it's not like I have a fully formed idea in my head. It's almost like solving a puzzle, putting things together, like seeing how they're going to work. And maybe even in the finished product, there's a couple of things where you then think, oh, that shouldn't have made it all the way through to this point. But I don't know. It's like they always say, you write films at least three times, when you write them, when you film them, then you edit them, because there's definitely things that you change when you're editing as well. But then even if I watch things that I've made, I'll think, oh, I could just tweak this one thing, I could just tweak another thing. I actually did this again the other day. I'll tell you about it later, because this is supposed to be about you. But I was watching an old video and I was like, oh, I'll just tweak that, and I did. I went back in and edited something.
I know how that feels. Yeah, it never feels like actually done. And if you think about it too, you could have edited it so many different ways. And it could be like actually so many different projects, like just like with the footage you have.
And then there's all those projects where people do like found footage, or they're like mashed together old and new things and put a new spin on things. And I think, I don't know, like part of why I have is this daunting idea that, well, everybody's doing this now, so not just what can I do to stand out, but like, why am I doing this?
Yeah, true. I think one thing for me as well, like I've realized that I've stopped reading fiction for a long time, and I've been getting back into reading like novels, and I think that I've been feeling very bored with the media that's been out lately, and I feel like reading is kind of like more satisfying than anything that they've been putting out, if that makes sense.
I think my only objection to things that are coming out now is it's mostly TV series and everything's serialized. So you can't, like, you used to just be able to watch an episode of something. Now, if you decide you're going to watch a show, you have to watch the entire thing. And I just can't be bothered. I think that's part of why I like movies, because I know, 2 hours or maybe 3 hours, if it's, because a lot of them are now, it's like it's going to be done, and I like to go in and have like a complete story. Like, and TV shows are great, but it's like, I know. Like,
Yeah, I think the part that is unsatisfying for me is the fact that, like, when you see a movie, a lot of times, like, so this is the thing that connects actually to Robert Bresson. Like, films nowadays want to show everything. It's not as like they don't obscure, they don't leave anything to the imagination. It's everything is shown, especially in our digital age where there's such high resolution. Now the style and the culture that we are all in, I think no matter where you are in the world, is that you show everything. But books, you need to utilize your imagination when you read a book because not everything is shown. So I think that it's more enjoyable like to read books, but then old movies actually did conceal more. Like they didn't show everything, and they would leave some scenes out, or they would obscure with like certain, I don't know, like a curtain or something, you know, like not a theater curtain, but just like a house curtain. Or I'm thinking about some of those ones by a Hitchcock, but it's like it didn't show everything, you know, and that's what made it more interesting, because it sort of lived in your imagination. It could take all these sort of forms, and that's, I think, what attracts me to storytelling, is that when it's like it's not defined in any solid way, and I think that that's what makes it more intriguing. But now it's difficult to be intrigued by films because they just show so much that it doesn't leave anything to the imagination, and it's just, you know what you saw, and you can't possibly imagine that it could have been any other way.
You've got a point. I wonder though, like it may have been out of necessity that older films did things better. I've thought about this myself because there was the production code, so there were certain things they weren't allowed to show.
It's that's part of it, but there is a theory within French film theory, and it's called economy in film. And so the idea of economy is that you don't show everything, precisely for the reason that I explained, that you choose what you show in order to highlight certain aspects over others. Because if you think about it, like in the digital filmmaking that we have now, everything's in focus. Or like, and now actually they're trying to utilize this sort of like a shallow depth of focus, only because they're trying to, they I think they understand that too much is in focus, and it's like no one knows what to look at, really. It's like it's a mess, and the compositions are.
Well, I agree with you, and I do agree that a lot of what you were saying before was just for artistic reasons too. I wasn't saying that's the only reason they did it, but it's kind of like the shallow focus thing. A lot of that, I think, is kids. I say kids because I'm old. I mean, like pe young, like filmmakers now who are up and coming who go, "Oh, this looks cinematic," because back when people were trying to make films with video cameras and things and mini DV, we couldn't do that because it, the lens, the length, the we had like these small apertures, and so everything was always in focus. And then all of a sudden people get DSLRs and like, oh, let's throw everything out of focus because it looks cinematic. But that's not necessarily aesthetically what you want. So if you look at a film from the 40s, I mean, if you look at something like Citizen Kane, there are big shots where everything's in focus, and that was hard to do.
Well, here's the thing though too, like so it's true, like the older films use deep focus, like more so than shallow focus, and but the thing was though, they didn't, they were more trying to compose it like a picture, like especially you mentioned Orson Welles, like there's a very famous shot where like he's playing out, you know, in the window, and he's framed by it. It's like everything was seen as if they're making a painting, so they really, using the deeper focus, they paid attention more to the composition to tell a story, rather than kind of having everything in focus, and then in the particularly emotional moments just kind of blurring everything out because you didn't really pay much. I mean, there's set design nowadays, but it's not, they're more, it's more of like trying to make people like actively in the environment rather than painting like this kind of artistic photo, like, or making, you know, like changing, yeah.
I agree, and there's already, you've got shot sizes and things that tell you what to look at, but if you do have an image where everything is in focus, you can almost choose what you're looking at. Or, maybe they want to hide something so that the second time you watch the movie, you're like, oh, it was there all along, but I was looking at this other thing. Whereas if the lens is saying, you look at this thing because this is the important thing, then you're more passive. And there's definitely a place for it. But I think you're right. There is a tendency now to light everything really well and just be like, okay, look at this thing, look at this thing, look at this thing.
You know, it's really interesting. I don't know, have you ever heard of Robert Bresson's theories on filmmaking? Because they're very different, I
Talk me
think,
through
than.
it.
So he had an idea that the director is the cinematographer in this. Is like the same person. So he did, like, he decided a lot of the cinematography for his own movies, and he had studied painting, so he used his like sort of painting skills to make these his shots, to compose them. And he also favored deep focus as well. I can't even think of any of his films that did have and ever had a shallow focus. But his idea was that at the time. So he preceded Jean-Luc Godard. Actually, Jean-Luc Godard was an assistant of his, and I think that he might have even cited him as one of his influences. So he was one of the first ones. I think he might have got started in like the 1940s was his first movie. Just to give you some context of the time, his idea was that people in the movie making, even back then, were trying to make theater like basically just filming theater, so that whatever you're seeing is just like it would have been on theater, but now there's like the it's could be distributed in a different way, and the sets are more realistic because the camera will kind of be this like omniscient eye. So that was like one side of the filmmaking. Then he had another side of filmmaking that he said that the camera is a medium that is misunderstood, and that the camera can see past all artifice. It can see when beyond like what someone's trying to portray, it sees actually the person. So he tried to strip all of that away, and he would only use people that he considered to be models, which is just his word for people that can't act, like they're not trained in acting. And he, in his mind, he said, I would never use a trained actor for movies, because what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to st like strip all of the artifice and like trying to like make yourself out to be something that you're not. I'm trying to strip all that away and just see it. And what I like so much about his movies is that, and I think in a similar way that I like documentary, is that you really do see the person, and it has like there it is real, like whatever you're seeing. And that's what makes it so profound. I mean, like I've cried at his when watching his films in a way that I never thought, like I never thought I'd be capable. I mean, like of a feeling an emotion like that. I mean, they're just amazing films. And I think, but they're very, that I think it's hard for people to get into them though, because the style is so different. But there's another point though that I was gonna make with that. Oh, this is the other point. I see a change too, because I think that Hollywood even started to notice that it's true that the camera is its own particular medium, and that the camera's eye is different than the human eye. That was one of his main points. The camera sees differently than we do, so they see past all of that, and it can remember differently than we can. And I think even Hollywood is starting to, not even starting to, I think they've done it for a while, but after a while the whole idea of like a theater actor just became ridiculous, because it did look fake. It looked silly. I mean, that's the era that he comes from as well, where it's just like the way they talked, that had so much airs to them, you know. It seemed wrong, you know. So nowadays, even in filmmaking, I do believe that Bresson's ideas live on in a sense, not maybe not as extreme as he wanted to go, like only using people that can't act. But nowadays it's like you have to look the part, you have to actually be that, you know. It's not like you just like look it. Like in theater, you could play like maybe from 20 to 60, you know. It really doesn't matter because you're a theater actor. But in film, like it went in a whole other direction, and it went more towards what Bresson had suggested. So in a way, I think he's a man before his time. But I'm very like interested in his theories on filmmaking, and how because he was the only one that really did it as extreme as he did.
I'm interested in a lot of what you've said, but one thing I want to talk about a little bit, because I know you've got experience on both ends here, is what are your thoughts on trained versus untrained actors, or even different methodologies of training? Like, what does it all mean?
I think like it's really different. I do agree with him that it should be different from theater versus film. And I think that a lot of what is intriguing in a film actor is their ability to, it's not like you don't want to see someone just, I mean, this is my opinion. Like I don't necessarily want to see someone try to become a character, try to take on another accent, you know, try to be something that they're not. I think it's, yeah, I have an idea about that. I really do believe that acting is just stripping away all of the boundaries and the protections that you've built for yourself. I think that a true actor would be have the courage to be vulnerable, because I saw that was when I was in New York City. Like I was when I was in my acting class, and in Buffalo as well, I was never once told by any of my teachers that I wasn't a good actor. In fact, they even used me as an example in class as what to do, both in both places. And I had a lot of actors come up to me after class and ask how I do it. And I think that a bit of it is my personality, because I've always been the type of a person that, like, I'll just start crying, you know, like even in public. And I think that I sort of lack that. I think it's I just have that vulnerability all the time, and I think it's a part of my personality. And I think that what they needed to try to do is like not try to be so strong and tough and all the time, but like when you see someone on screen, it's like you want to see them at their most vulnerable, and in fact see a lot of who that person is. And if you're afraid to show yourself, it's going to be counterproductive. So I would say, like, with all this like monologue training and like, you know, like acting training and trying to get into the character and reading and stuff, like all of that's fine for getting to know the character. But really, I think what seems to make the best actor is like when you make it real for yourself, and the only way to do that is to be vulnerable. And so I think that it's not really as complicated as people make it out to be. I think it's just a matter of being vulnerable, and all the other stuff just comes with just understanding the character that you're playing. What do you think of that?
I largely agree with you. I think it depends on the role as well, because there are parts that are parts. Like there are parts where the character is a believable human being, and then there are characters, in quotes, where they're kind of a vessel for the plot, in which case, you want like the action hero, or like the this is angry person, this is sad person, and they're almost caricatures rather than humans. And then I think, sure, if you want to give a persona, like a version of what that looks like, there's ways to do it believably that maybe go against the person's natural instincts, or maybe they don't. But I agree with you that the most interesting things are where you kind of see a range of human emotion throughout the piece. And you believe the person in each situation. And I mean, personally, I don't know how other actors do this. I mean, I'm being a bit grandiose myself, I guess, but I find it easier if I just kind of go with it and just, believe, not like believe it's happening, because obviously you're acting, but just kind of like go with the emotions and think, that if I were in this situation, how would it affect me? And like let yourself be affected by the imaginary circumstances. It's gonna.
Yeah. I think a lot of that goes back to casting as well too, because I noticed that like the idea of an acting range, I think, has come from theater, and people are still using this term. But really, when it really comes down to it, the same person that will play an ingenue is not also going to be a femme fatale most of the time. You know, it's like, because really the reason why you're getting cast as a certain role in a movie is because you have a sort of look, and
Yeah, a
people.
look or a quality about you, and I think that's true. Because I mean, like Lauren Bacall was what, 19 when she like came straight out of the bat doing the femme fatale thing. So it's not an age thing. It's a
It's like an essence that this,
charisma in essence. Yeah.
and I think more and more that's the case with casting. So I think that if you want to talk about range, then sure. I mean, maybe for theater, but I don't know if it really applies to, especially the way that film is often cast, like in terms of a business.
I don't know though, because then there are actors who I believe. I've seen them play really meek characters, and I've seen them play really strong characters, and I've always kind of, I go along with it. And it's kind of harder in a way once you've seen an actor in one thing to then believe them as something else. So it's almost strange to me that we do have celebrities and stars and, recurring actors, because it would almost be better to go back to Japanese traditions where you kind of play the same character or the same character type your entire life, because on the one hand, it's, oh, look, this person played this and now they're playing this and they're cool. And a lot of that acting, doing different accents and things, a lot of that gets credit.
Yeah, but I don't necessarily think that that is range, though. I think that that's just the what that person has in them, and that people are, you know, at times paradoxical, multifaceted. You know, they've got a lot of traits, some of which could be, in conflict with one another and within their personality. So I don't think that any of that is necessarily like outside of who that person is. I still think that there's a truthfulness too. And so I would agree with you that it's true. People don't have to play just one type.
So I suppose then my next question is, what is your idea of like what would range, how would you define that, the way you want to use it?
I think it's a theater term. I mean, I think it's like it's what you can't like. So theater, it's like it goes from the outward, it like in, right? Like, no, not. It's like you put on a costume and you make your mannerism something that is outside of you. So
Right.
it's like I play like an old woman on stage. I can't do that in film, but I could do it on stage with the right costumes and the right like kind of mannerisms where I look like I'm in pain when I'm walking, maybe. So that's I think what ranges as an actor. It's like for theater. But I just don't know if it even really applies to film. I mean, film is such a new medium. It hasn't really been around that long. And we're you trying to use these old theater terms when we're talking about film,
Yeah.
but film is like you really like it just looks crazy on film. You know, if you tried to do that, it would look
No,
insane.
I agree with you. I think maybe I was I'm used to thinking more in terms of film, so maybe I've kind of adopted the terminology for that, and now I'm like, oh yeah, you've got a good point.
Because like sometimes it refers to also like emotions or like maybe character types too, right? When you're saying rage. So
Yeah, I think I was thinking more along those kind of.
but I don't see that as being outside of like just yourself. I mean, it's kind of like exploring different parts of yourself because you're still it's but it, I think that the ideal within filmmaking I don't think I'm just speaking for myself. I think I'm speaking for like all filmmakers because of the like the culture that we have is that there has to be truth to it. It can't seem fake or unnatural in any way, and that because it seems feels off to people. But I think that would go over very well in theater because of the space, because people can't really see what you're doing on any like in detailed way. You know, they can't see a look in your eyes, they can't see any of that. But that's why I love film so much, because you miss so much when you see people in real life, like little passing glances that they might have. But there are some actors too that I think really are very good in film. Like I was just watching Die Hard, like the third Die Hard yesterday, and I was watching Jeremy Irons, and like he had this one moment where it's like he like the Bruce Willis makes fun of his brother dying, and then he had this like flash of anger, and then he switches like and it's just gone. And it's like you wouldn't not see that in theater. You would just not notice it, but it's like you can notice like little things like that. But what I don't like though is that when they try to make it like some actors, I think because of the theater training is getting mixed up with film training, that they'll try to go outside in the same way that the same way that they would in theater, so that they'll say like I'll have a look on my face as if that's going to be acting. And I think that every time, I would say 10 times out of 10, people can tell that there's a difference
Yeah.
between something that you're just actually experiencing and it's a real reaction that you're experiencing because your imagination is just taking you through it in such a great way, versus something that you would just like put like, oh, I'm gonna look angry right now. It's like I think that people can sense that it's different. That Robert Bresson said about his own films, even though people didn't understand them and people were angry at him for not using actors. Because it just looked like he was, he was accused of just being against the world and just not wanting to do anything nor like a normal person. But he said that people were very emotionally affected by his films, and I think that's because of how real they were. Like it was insane to me. I watched this one film of his, and this woman, she's not an actor, she's just fake crying on a bed. You know, she's and it's fake. We know it's fake. You know. But she's just going through the motions. But because in a way it's real because she's not forcing it. So she just is doing this and like kind of going like that. It's like it's so much more affecting than someone who's like trying to seem like they're sad. And I cried so much when I saw that. And I think there's more components to that too. It was the composition of the scene and the fact that it looked sort of like a painting, the way she looks so small, and then the person that was making her upset was like so big. And sorry, I'm getting on these tangents. I have so many thoughts and I go so fast.
This is kind of the whole point of the podcast. Like, I just kind of like serve the ball and then let you go with it, you know?
I think my descriptions are getting kind of mixed up though. I'm talking, it's like I start talking about one thing and then I'm like, oh, but then I could talk about that and then I could talk about that and I go in like all these directions.
But I think to kind of bring that about in a roundabout way, that is, it's both how our minds work and it's how film works and it's how dreams work. Because I think, you know, a lot has been said about films as dreams, and I think they are almost a visual representation of dreams, because it's like the thing you're thinking about is the image you see, whereas in real life you can't do that. So like you were saying about theater, you know, you're distanced from it and it's all has to be bigger so that you can see what's happening. And whereas film, you can get into these like really intimate angles and ideas that you could never do in real life. So I think maybe there's a third art somewhere that's kind of more natural and realistic. I don't know if that'd be like something like Tokyo Story, where you just get like a fixed angle and watch the thing. But even that's more like theater. You know, maybe there is like a weird mid space. I guess video games. You know, you can kind of move around and interact with things.
Yeah, there's some filmmakers. I like definitely Robert Bresson wouldn't have been among the ones that would want to make it dreamlike, but there's definitely some filmmakers that lean into the dream, like the dreamlike aspect that film could make. There's one in particular who made Shadows of Forgotten Ancestors, is a Ukrainian film. I don't remember his name's Sergei. I don't remember, it starts with a P, but I don't know how to pronounce it, so I don't want to try. But he made one that where yeah, it's very dreamlike and kind of like yeah. The people have all sorts of styles with film. I guess that's where the term auteur came from, because when you make a film, sometimes like it just looks so much in your own particular style that it's almost like it's like your own special brand of reality.
I wouldn't, I'm not there yet. I don't know. I want to believe that films are collaborative. And one of the things that bugs me is how the director gets the credit when they're not even the writer. And I'm like, well, you're not an auteur, are you? You're doing your version of somebody else's story. That's, I think, you know, if it is one person doing everything, then fair enough, you could argue that. But it's just, it's too hard to make a film by yourself. Believe me, I know. I kind of see it a bit as like what I've been doing, you know, since I was a kid. I just like making things out of Lego, you know, just like, here's a bunch of stuff, let's make a thing. And so I think maybe there are auteurs who not do it by accident, but you know, you can't, you know, you don't go, right, I'm going to make a thing about this. You know, maybe they just have a nagging feeling that, okay, I have to do this. And then their kind of themes come out, but I don't think in a lot of cases, I think maybe it's not the person saying, I want to show this, and then it happens. Or maybe I'm just being naive. I don't know.
Well, I don't know if we're using the word auteur the same way. Like what I meant by auteur is like you mentioned Tokyo Story by Ozu, right? So Ozu's style, that's pretty distinctive. I would say that you could even just watch some stills, look at some stills, and you would know that that's Ozu. That's what I meant by auteur. Like someone that it's a filmmaking term because of how tied it is to visuals. And so I think that that's what I take an auteur to mean. I mean, it does have to do with philosophy as well. But when I think of an auteur, I think of like something being distinctive about the way that the person makes films so that you could always recognize it as being theirs. And I think that that's why some people talk about it, like they would like to become an auteur, they would like to have such a unique fingerprint in their filmmaking. But I think that you're right. It's like it's not something that you should just try to like achieve. It's more of like you sh it's like films is for expressing your deepest emotions. And I do agree with you. I think that that's what you were saying, right?
What you said sounded like a very succinct way of saying what I was trying to
Yeah.
say.
Okay. I don't know what I'm saying half the time either. I mean, I hope that half of what I said made sense, because I really do think very fast. It's like I can't catch up with my own thoughts sometimes. Are you similar? It seems like
I
you
mean,
said.
you're in good company. Quentin Tarantino is the same, and he's doing okay.
I feel like he's more coherent when he talks, though. I mean, I can follow what he says. He just speaks really fast and very emphatically. I like hearing him speak.
I think if I would say anything about you, and maybe I do this too, is you kind of interrupt your own thought mid-thought with another thought. You'll be saying one thing and then get distracted by something else and kind of chip in. It's like you're having a conversation with yourself, and I think I am guilty of that to a degree.
I think that that's why I like writing so much more, because writing, you can edit your own words so that it, like, all your thoughts, but like I interrupt my own writing too when I'm doing it, and it's that's why I was kind of intimidated to do a podcast, because I don't trust how I speak, like, especially if it's not already like pre-planned or written down like that. It's like, okay, this, you know, and like, I mean, I think I could give a speech like no problem, but just the kind of freehand, like freestyling, it is just dangerous with the way I think, I think.
I didn't realize you were nervous about it, so that's you're doing fine.
Oh, that's good.
So is filmmaking now, do you see it as kind of a long-term thing that you want to do? Like, is this something you're going to stick with and kind of push yourself to be a filmmaker, or is it another art you're exploring? Because I mean, between your opera and your acting and now you're writing and directing, are you kind of searching for your creative outlet? Or is this something that you're like, okay, maybe I found it now?
Film has always been special to me for the reasons that I've said, because of how deep it can go into the person, you know, because I yeah. Let's start over with that answer. I want to say this actually. My interest in film and opera, I think, is connected. And is almost in a way the same interest, because they're both extremely grand and vast art forms that combine more than one discipline at a time. Like film will combine writing and visuals, you know, and music. And opera is very much the same, where there's costumes, there's set design, there's the tone of the opera singers' voices that will either, you know, kind of clash with or will be good for the characters that they're in. And then there's the music itself, that is a whole other language. And in my mind, it paints these really vast landscapes when I listen to it. And I feel like you feel a sort of intimacy, even though it's so large, because of the music, especially like Mozart's music. You feel an emotional intimacy with the characters at the same time. And I think film does that as well. So I've been very interested in combining the two art forms in the future. One thing that I've been talking about with my classical music colleagues as well is that opera for it is art of the past, in that the way that people enjoy it is no longer the norm for how people are entertained right now. What I mean by that is that in the past, we had books, we had theater, we had opera. A lot of that was just, you know, like your imagination had to fill in the gaps for what you didn't see. Because opera is, you know, a lot of it's text-based as well. And of course, with reading, like you're not seeing anything. But the way that we enjoy art nowadays is mostly visual, and there's not a whole lot of like Netflix is entertainment. It's like what people watch when they go home from work and they don't want to have to think. They just want to sort of like watch it. So the way that people are entertained nowadays has va is vastly different from the past. And I think that in a way, opera is stuck in the past by only having theater works. I love them. I mean, I hope that they never leave. And I do think that people can enjoy it if they allow themselves to try to be entertained in the way that we are have been in the past. But the way I see it, that is that opera has to be made visual in order for it to be relevant in future generations. So part of my project, what I've wanted to do, is render visual the unique and exquisite poetry, words, and emotions that the opera music combined with the words portrays. And
And is that what you've what you feel you've achieved with your new short.
I don't know if I've achieved it. I mean, I hope I have. I hope that it's interesting to people. I love this music, and I'm very biased, because I haven't needed to know the words right away. I was just immediately in love with the music, and I perceived the emotions already without it having to be described to me, to the point where often I would listen to the music and I would already know exactly what was happening even before reading the words, or I would be so intrigued by what was happening that I would want to know the words. Like when I was in high school, I remember for hours I would just be in my room with a copy of an English libretto, an Italian libretto, and the recording for Le Nozze di Figaro, and I would listen to that over and over again and just appreciate each of the words, learn the Italian and the English, and like hear how each word is emphasized with the music, the ones that are de-emphasized, like all the different things that were going on, because it's so complicated. And I was just very intrigued and interested in it. So I'm always very interested in opera. I hope that I can help people to see what I see in it, because I'm in love with it. The art songs in particular, like the language of them is so exquisite. And I think that actually some fashion editorials kind of convey that sometimes, because you'll see that the sort of like a visual poetry in them, like with the choices that they make, and it all kind of like blends, or it's supposed to like clash somehow. And I think that's what I would like to do with with these poems, like these artistic poems that are set to classical music, is like show how beautiful it is, because I know it in my mind, in my imagination, but I think that if it were to be rendered, maybe other people would start to understand just what's out there. Because I mean, you can't blame people. It's in a whole other language. It's my cat. Sorry, he's upset because I've locked him out. So I'll let him come in. Okay, you can come in. Yeah, that wasn't a baby. It was a cat. Yeah, he just walked away now. He was just upset because it was closed. Oh no, here he is. Yeah, here he is.
There really is a cat for the people listening.
Yeah. So wait, what were we talking about?
Your cat. I don't know. No, we're talking about your short and what you're trying to do with it. And I was just kind of taken in by how little I know and how, like, now kind of curious I am to find out.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it's I hope that people like it, but I think that because we live in such a visual age, like almost all the art forms that we consume is visual. Like even like in terms of social media and Instagram, like a lot of what we take in is so like we don't really read text. I mean, you really can't consider Twitter text because it's just so short. Like long form text is just not what people are used to anymore.
It's not so much, I mean, personally, it's not so much the visual form that gets me as this idea of everything's competing for your attention span against everything else. I was listening to a thing and it said Netflix, they were competing against all these other streaming services, but Netflix is actually competing against sleep. Like, they don't want you to do anything except watch Netflix.
Yeah, it seems so. It's like it's made to be very addictive.
Yeah. And I mean, at least those are real TV shows, but the things you were saying, like TikTok and Instagram and Facebook and refreshing web pages and all this kind of stuff. And, I'm as guilty of it as anyone else. And it's just like, why do I do this? Like, I could be doing meaningful things, but because all this kind of stuff is just like there and it's like an instant hit, it's like, oh, or I think civilization fell apart when they invented the like button. It's,
You know what? I think you might be right.
That, I
The
think that's the moment where it happened.
like button's kind of creepy too.
Yeah.
It's like approving, disapproving, it's like, and it's just making such a quick judgment on someone you know nothing about. It's pretty scary.
Yeah. It is, and it's it plays into everyone's insecurities as well, I think.
Yeah,
But then
yeah.
now, as you say, they've weaponized it, and looking at castings, people will go, oh, how many Instagram followers does this person have when making a judgment?
But it's money too. I mean, a lot of that, like actually all of it's money, because that the amount of followers you have is like how much you're worth monetarily, I think.
I guess.
All the same.
Yeah. And I ain't worth nothing.
Same. Not really
Yet.
though. I guess with what you were saying about it being like really like addictive, yeah. But the thing is though, like reading, I would be interested to see how many people read, because I gave up reading fiction for a while because I just felt like I had to do so many practical things that it was like I was worried that I was spending too much time reading fiction and wasn't like immediately like of pragmatic value to my life. So I recently just got back into it, and I noticed that like I had an overnight difference in the way that I thought, and also the way that I wrote letters and stuff. Like it just improved immediately, and I'm very concerned that with everyone focusing so much like on Twitter for news and everything, it's like I don't think it's possible to really construct a really well thought out idea in such a short amount of characters and in letters. And I'm a little bit afraid of what that has been doing, because if you think about it, like the one thing that bothers me most about social media is how rude everyone is. And I don't think it's just because of how we're separate from each other, like and I don't think it's just the anonymity. I also think it's because of how short people write, because in a way a short thought is a rude thought. You're not really giving that person a lot of time. You're not really thinking about what you're going to tell them. You just give them something very quick. And I think a lot of people, when they read a comment or a response to their comment, they read it in a rude tone of voice, even if it's not intended that. And then they are very rude in response. And I see that over and over again in online communication, especially on Twitter. I mean, people getting into like really bad Twitter arguments with a stranger that they've never met. And it's like that's. And I believe it's because of the format that they're in, because they're not together a well thought out, like, 20 page essay.
Something that you said right there just sounds like the genesis of something to explore. A short thought is a rude thought. And I think to off the back of what you said, there's this sense that everything has to be right now. So I was talking about how I don't like the like button, even though I use it. That I think the other thing that really has changed things is read receipts. You know, because like if you can see that someone's seen a thing and then it's kind of like, or if you know you've read a thing, then you have this kind of ticking clock in your head. Okay, I've got to react to that.
Yeah, that's a lot of pressure. I mean, I think I had that talk with someone else the other day too, that they were out of work, and then they kept getting like these like emails and stuff and messages, and there's like this constant anxiety and pressure that you have to respond to people immediately, or else you're going to be considered like ignoring them. Yeah, that's pretty difficult. Nothing like the writing, I guess, that
I make it a point to not have my work email on my phone, and like people have called me out and I was like, why? And I was like, because it's my phone, not my work phone. Like,
it's like become the new norm. Like now you're
right.
expected to always be on, no matter where you are. Well, why don't you have your phone with you? Yeah, and I agree with you. I think that it just is unnecessary like anxiety, because it used to be that your work life is your work life, and then your personal life was separate, but how can you make it separate when you've constantly got the notifications?
Yeah, we're going completely off topic, but I love that we're like
Yeah.
exploring something.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of people probably think like we do as well. They probably have the same thoughts. It's like, why am I having my work phone? Like, I
But
mean,
I think we all know that it's a problem, and yet none of us really know how to escape it, or we're kind of tied to it. And like now, things like smartphones, this is really off topic, but like, you know, during COVID and everything, you go to a restaurant and all the menus are a QR code. So n there isn't the option to not have a smartphone anymore
that's very,
because,
yeah.
you know, receipts are on it, tickets are on it, everything's paperless. And it's kind of like if you don't have a smartphone, you're not in the world. And not
What I
having a
love is,
smartphone now is like not having your keys.
how did this start,
No
Ish?
idea.
How? Who did
Oh,
this?
I don't know.
We need to find them. Oh, and we need to tell them that they start something bad, and they need to reverse it.
What one thing that I am really grateful for is I'm just old enough that I remember the world without the internet. So I have like the distinction in my head. I can remember pre-internet and post-internet world.
Yeah,
Like,
I'm similarly old as you, and I also have this experience, and I think that it's terrible if you didn't grow up with that experience. Because I think I was much happier when there wasn't so much internet around.
I don't know. It's impossible to say.
So as well? Are you not sure?
I'm not sure because I can see lots of benefits of it. Things like Facebook, and I can be connected with anyone I've ever met in passing. Or, in some ways, I like the connectedness, but because it is so shallow, and the thing that I really hate is we're constantly being sold things, or we are constantly being sold. Like, why couldn't it just be for the good of humanity? Why did they have to monetize it?
Makes sense to me that they would, though.
Yeah, of
I
course they would. Of course they would. Why wouldn't they? Someone can make money off it. Of course you're going to do that.
Yeah, but it's like there's never been a time where people actually like became commodities as now. Like actually commoditizing themselves too. But I mean we all see that happening. I mean, I'm pretty sure like the average person like knows it's happening. It's just no one wants to live any differently because it's just that's what the society we're in. And
And I'm sure a lot of people benefit from it as well. Maybe I do too, without even,
yeah.
consciously thinking about it.
Yeah,
I
there's
mean,
like some.
I definitely do. I mean, like, so now I can make a movie and I can, put that movie online and people can see it. Whereas if there weren't wasn't an internet, it would be like whoever I could like get to come around to my house and watch it. That's where it would end.
I mean, the fact that it actually like got shown in India too. I keep harping on
I
that.
well, that's just incredible to me. I mean, that's piracy for you. Like, long live the pirates. Like,
I don't know, it's kind of cool piracy though. I mean,
but I've grown to love Tubi, not just because my film's on there, but I started using it, and I love the mix. There's kind of big studio films on there with huge budgets, and then there's just like tiny obscure things, and I like how they've kind of rebranded themselves as like go down this rabbit hole. And there's all kinds of weird, obscure things on there. It's great, and you can watch things made with no money from anywhere in the world, or you can watch big Hollywood things. And I just think it's really good. It's a lot of fun, but it's Fox, so it's all part of the evil empire in the end.
do you like any of those movies that are like supposedly bad movies, but like they're bad but they're good at the same time?
I mean, I like ridiculous movies for like their sheer gall a lot of the times. I got my Sharknado Blu-ray signed by the director in that movie we were on. I like things that are kind of, because we were talking about how we appreciate films that are art and they're trying to say something, but I do appreciate things that are like unashamed. I'm just gonna make something ridiculous and have you smile. Like, that is completely worthwhile. Like something like snakes on a plane. It's like, okay, I'm in. Show me some snakes on a plane.
Yeah, I feel
And
the same about those. Have
it,
you ever seen The Room by Tommy?
yes, I have seen The Room. Yeah, that's the kind of degree of filmmaking that I'm aspiring to in this. But it's the raw passion. Like, that he's being completely earnest about it.
Yeah.
Whereas I think, something like Snakes on a Plane and Sharknado, like, they know they're being ridiculous. Whereas The Room, he's just trying to make a good movie.
But he's also himself. I think that that's what people find so inspiring.
Yeah.
He's just himself and he doesn't apologize for it. And I think that's why people like him so much.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
Right, since we're just chatting about life and not so much about you as a filmmaker, is there anything else that you want to share with people or promote to people? Or, but now that we've just said how horrible social media is, do you want people to like follow you and all that stuff?
Oh, man. Okay. So, yeah, I mean, I've got a website. Right now, the domain is www.victoria-hutton.com. And my Instagram is Victoria Hutton with two underscores at the end. I
You need
feel
to.
like I talk about myself so much though with what we were ta discussing. Like everything I said is like all my ideas about filmmaking, it seems like also very personal at the same time.
I found it really interesting, but for my part, I felt like, I don't know if you're going to listen to any of my other episodes, but I felt like this is the most intrusive I've been. Like, I've talked about myself a lot, and I generally kind of avoid that because I'll talk about myself all day long, but I get a bit weird about turning this into the me show.
Yeah. I feel somewhat embarrassed to talk about myself.
It's too late now.
I am in the
Right, let's bring this to a closing. With any luck, I will get this edited this week purely so that I can get people to go along to the Valkyrie Film Festival and watch both of your movies.
hole.
And a lot of people listening to this are probably back home for me as well, so they're not going to go, but the local people might. Sorry, I'll have to share it online. And if you want me to like promote any of your other links and things, just tell me and I'll include them in the description of the episode.
I would appreciate that very much.
That's all right. Other than that, thanks for talking to me for this. And yeah, hopefully there'll be another episode soon, guys. I'll see you
Thanks
next year.
for inviting and having me.
It was good. I knew you'd be a good person to talk to.
Okay.
Because you stole half my award, so I figure, there's something in there.
The way I remember it, we got two full awards. There are just two of them.
Yeah, no, that's not how I say
Thank
it. All right.